forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. My guest is Jody Magnus. She's a Keenan Distinguished Professor for Teaching Excellence in Early Judaism. Our website is jodimagnus.org, and Jody is J-O-D-I, Magnus is M-A-G-N-E-S-S.org. She's also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Philosophy and Religious Studies. She holds a senior endowed chair in the Department of Religious Studies at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Many, many other accolades, which she would better explain than I would. So welcome to the podcast, Jody. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, if you want to tell me what initially sparked your curiosity in the areas that you study, you know, maybe a little bit of background on yourself.
Sure. So I've actually wanted to be an archaeologist since I was 12 years old. And it was thanks to a couple of things. First of all, a seventh grade history teacher who introduced us to the ancient world. I fell in love with ancient Greece and especially Athens. And that was really kind of the focus of my interest ever since then, the classical world. And at the same time, I was going to Girl Scout camp in the Pocono Mountains and finding fossils of shells, and also had the usual childhood fascination with dinosaurs. So it all just came together. And ever since then, I wanted to be an archaeologist. Yeah, kind of a one-track mind.
Oh, that's cool, though. Have you done, I guess, what they call biblical archaeology? Have you done digs to find corroborating sites and names and things like that in the, you know, from the Old Testament?
Right. So, yeah, that's a big question, actually, that I need to unpack. So, technically, the period I specialize in the Roman, Byzantine, and early Islamic periods in ancient Palestine, meaning the area of modern Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian territories. And technically, in academia, the periods that I work in are not considered biblical archaeology. They're considered post-biblical because in the academic definition, biblical archaeology is the period of the Old Testament, right? And I would work in the period of the New Testament and even later. So that's one thing. The second thing is that, you know, even if we extend what I, you know, the word biblical archaeology to include what I do, which in some circles, you know, it is included. Even if we do that, that's not what archaeologists do. In other words, archaeology is not a discipline where biblical archaeology, for example, not a discipline where what we do is look to find things that will verify the Bible or not, or disprove it. That's not what archaeology is about. So archaeology is the study of the human past by focusing on the remains of human material culture. So, for example, whereas somebody who is trained in as an historian would learn about the past by reading written documents, right? Things that people wrote and that we still have today. Archaeologists learn about the past by digging up human material culture. Human material culture would be anything that people manufactured and left behind. So think pottery or architecture or tombs or coins or whatever. And archaeology is a science, even though it's not an exact science. So in the exact sciences, the goal is to replicate the experiment. In archaeology, the experiment cannot be replicated because once we've dug the remains out of the ground, we've destroyed the evidence along the way. So we can't replicate it. We have to carefully document everything that we do and then publish it afterwards as fully as possible so that we have a complete record of the evidence that we destroyed while conducting our experiment, so to speak. And so like any other scientists, archaeologists don't go out to dig just to, you know, randomly dig and find stuff because we know that you're going to find something when you dig. And we don't dig in order to try and verify the Bible. That's not what motivates us. What we do is we approach the past, like any other science, with questions that we hope to answer by digging up the remains of human material culture. And so basically what we have are one or more research questions. And the hope is that in the course of excavation, we will find data, we will find remains that will help us answer those questions. So to give you a concrete example of that, my current excavation is at an ancient Jewish village in Galilee. It's called Hukok, where, among other things, we've brought to light the remains of a monumental synagogue building that is actually featured in this month's issue of National Geographic magazine. And the reason I started, yeah, it is very cool, actually. The reason I started this excavation in 2011 was that I had a couple of big research questions I hoped to answer. And one of them was, what was the fate of Jewish villages like Hukok when they came under Christian rule beginning in the 4th century AD? Because, of course, in the 4th century, the Roman Empire became a Christian empire. And these Jewish settlements like Hukok, which is located in Lower Eastern Galilee, came under Christian rule, right? They were already under Roman rule, but when the Roman Empire became a Christian empire, now they're under Christian rule. And many of my colleagues, especially in Israel, think that Christian rule was oppressive to Jews and that these settlements declined and maybe even some of them disappeared beginning in the 4th century. And my impression from archaeology was always exactly the opposite. And this was one of the questions that I was hoping to answer, to excavate a Jewish village of this period and see what those remains indicate about the fate of this village in the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries. And
example? Like, what would you see this to tell if life is good or bad under Roman?
Great question. So we have houses of this period that were actually built during this period that are village houses, but they're well-built, sturdy village houses. But the main thing is the synagogue building, which was built around the year 400 AD. And the reason why we've gotten so much publicity, including from National Geographic, is because this monumental synagogue building, it's a very large building, was entirely paved inside with beautiful mosaic floors that depict an array of biblical stories. They're absolutely incredible mosaics. And obviously, they were very costly. The rest of the building was costly. It was a big building. It also had colorful wall paintings inside. So it obviously indicates a very high level of prosperity among the villagers. Exactly in the period when some of my colleagues argue these Jewish settlements were declining and even disappearing. So that is the kind of evidence, right, that I was hoping to find. And in fact, it's even more than I was expecting to find. But that gives you an example of the kind of research question that, you know, that an archaeologist would have in order to start, you know, to start an excavation.
What kind of mosaics and see what stories have been picked?
Oh, we have all kinds of different stories. We have three different episodes of Samson's exploits. We have the biblical judge and prophetess Deborah and the biblical heroine Yael driving a stake through the temple of the Canaanite general Sisera. We have scenes from the book of Daniel. We have Isaiah 11, the peaceful kingdom. We have the story of Jonah, the building of the Tower of Babel, Noah's Ark, the Pharaoh's soldiers drowning in the Red Sea. I mean, we have a whole array of different biblical stories.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very cool.
So why do you say that conditions had to be good? Is it because if they weren't, that would have been destroyed or defaced? Like why?
No, well, first of all, yes, they were actually obviously free to build this and decorate this synagogue. But the fact that they were even able to afford a building like this, right? So we have houses that are built at around the same time as the synagogue, and the synagogue then built also around 400 AD, and obviously indicating a relatively high level of prosperity, an unexpectedly high level of prosperity in this village. Now, I cannot extrapolate and say that the same is true of all the other villages in the area, right? But I can say that at least in the excavations that I've conducted in this particular village, the picture that we have contradicts the sort of claim that Jewish villagers suffered in this period under oppressive Christian rule.
So is there any evidence for that, or it was just lamentations from what happened? Like, why would,
why would anybody think that? Right. That's a really great question. And that is actually, so again, it's dictated by the nature of the evidence that you use. So if you look, for example, at Christian writings of this same period, they're very negative about Jews, right? They're attacking Jews all the time. If you look at later Roman legislation, the later Roman emperors issued laws which seemed to be oppressive to Jews, forbidding, for example, the construction of new synagogue buildings, prohibiting Jews from proselytizing, you know, converting non-Jews to Judaism. So
why would this be attributed to Christianity and not, let's say, to the, you know, the Jewish revolts and the Second Temple being destroyed and, you know, all the other activities? And the only interaction they had with the Romans.
Sure. Yeah. But this occurs quite a ways after that, right? So the destruction of the Second Temple occurred in the year 70 AD. And the Bar Kokhba revolt, which you mentioned, which is very important, by the way, was 132 to 135 or 136 AD. And we're now talking 4th, 5th, 6th centuries, right? So this is, you know, a couple of centuries later than the Bar Kokhba revolt. And it's not to say that all of that is completely irrelevant, but we're in a different historical, you know, context now.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
Even though it was several hundred years later, maybe somehow the cultural memory of what happened with, you know, what happened in the New Testament, or again, the revolts of the Jews or the temple being burned down, you know, in a Roman experience, that was still somehow remembered strongly. And then when Christianity was at the fore, you know, and the Romans again became like a Christian empire, as you said, maybe there was this, again, this remembrance of things that happened in the past a few hundred years ago, but they decided to take it out on them now, even though it's so much time had passed.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, not exactly, actually. I mean, so yes and no. I mean, you know, what happens after 70 and then again after the Bar Kokhba revolt is that the temple is destroyed. And then after the Bar Kokhba revolt, it becomes clear that the temple's not going to be rebuilt at any time in the near future. And, you know, at some point sooner or later, Judaism and Christianity part and go their own ways, right? And both of them basically laid claim to the same religious heritage, right? Both of them claim to be the true Israel and to appropriate for their own the biblical heritage, right? And so that is, in fact, the kind of dialogue, if you wish to put it in neutral terms, that you see between Jews and Christians as time goes on. So there is ultimately some kind of a connection with that. But because before the time of Constantine in the 4th century, Christianity was an illegal, outlawed religion in the Roman Empire, Christians couldn't worship openly. They couldn't practice their religion freely. And so even though in Christian writings before the time of Constantine, Christian attitudes towards Jews become negative very early on, actually, and then grow increasingly antagonistic and negative as time goes on, the Christians weren't able to actually take any, you know, real negative action against Jews until Christianity was in control, right? Once the Christian Empire is...
Exactly.
Christian Empire, right? And the Roman emperors are Christian emperors, right? So that's when that picture kind of changes. So, but as far as their mosaics go, I mean, the mosaics are really interesting because they seem to sort of, there's a combination of things going on, but a lot of them highlight the great things that the God of Israel did in the past for his people, right? And especially when they're fighting against enemies, the enemies of Israel, with kind of the implication then being, this is what God did for us in the past, and this is what he's going to do for us again in the future. And that's combined with some mosaics like the Daniel scenes and the Isaiah 11, and probably also Samson, by the way, which also hint towards these kind of eschatological or apocalyptic expectations that the current world order, you know, will not last, and that eventually it will end and God's kingdom will be established on earth. And this is kind of what we have to look forward to. So there are multiple things going on in the mosaics and the choice of the mosaics.
Yeah. When I was talking about cultural memory, you know, let's look at, like, for a quick second, like slavery in the U.S. So some people, it happened in the 50s, 60s. Some may be talking about contemporary ones, and some may be talking about stuff that happened, you know, near the formation of the U.S., late 1700s. So that constitutes, at least I think, you know, again, a long cultural memory. So let's say they want to say, oh, we want reparations. And I'm not saying it's good or bad or any of that. I'm just saying that for several hundred years, this has been in the consciousness of, like, the American people. And now it may be manifesting in different ways, even though it's, you know, again, a couple hundred years later. So perhaps maybe that's what happened, even though, again, it was 400 years after Christ, let's say. Maybe there was still this memory of what had happened with the Jews, and that's why they were treated like that at that point. Again, I have no idea. Just a thought.
Well, no, it's complicated, right, what you're saying. And
I'll give you one more quick example. Like, here's what brings to mind. So, like, with Russia. So some people have said, oh, Putin wants to close the 9 gates, you know, these 9 geographical gates to stop invasions of Russia because they've been invaded countless times over 1,000 years. So to me, that sounds like crazy because it's been 1,000 years, so long ago, but it seems to have this long cultural memory of things that happened many, 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 many years ago, and it still shapes how they think today. So perhaps that was what was happening. That's why I thought about it.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
No, I mean, you're not incorrect. you know, the Jerusalem temple and ultimately its destruction in 70 is certainly a cultural memory that shaped both Judaism and Christianity, right? And ultimately kind of shaped the kind of relations between the followers of the two religions. And then you can add Islam later into the mix. And that's still going on today, right? And I don't want to talk about today because I'm an archaeologist and I want to focus on the past. But, you know, so that is definitely a shared cultural memory. The differences in the way the different, you know, followers of those religious traditions view that cultural memory, so to speak, right? So for Jews, of course, the disruption of the temple in 70 was a disastrous event. And traditionally, Judaism has always looked forward to the rebuilding of the temple again one day in the future. Whereas for Christians, if you accept Jesus as the ultimate sacrifice, right, there's no need for an earthly temple to be rebuilt. And therefore, for Christians, there's the whole question of an earthly temple is irrelevant. And so it's not surprising then to see ancient synagogues like our synagogue at Hukok, but other synagogues of this period as well, filled with images that allude to directly or indirectly the Jerusalem temple, because that's always been kind of the focal point, right? We are awaiting the rebuilding of the temple one day. Whereas in Christianity, even though Christian churches of the period of Hukok are decorated with some of the same biblical stories, like the offering of Isaac by Abraham is very popular in both Christian and Jewish art in this period, but they're using it to broadcast different messages, right? For Jews, the offering of Isaac by Abraham broadcasts this sort of message of, you know, God's promise to Abraham and is connected with Mount Moriah, which is the site of the Jerusalem temple, or comes to be identified with the site of the Jerusalem temple, the Temple Mount, and sacrifice itself, right? The idea of sacrifice itself. Whereas for Christians, that same episode displaying that in their churches would signify, you know, a kind of a precursor, if you wish, to Jesus' sacrifice, right? God's sacrifice of his own son, Jesus, right? As the ultimate sacrifice. So absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And that what you're talking about here is a cultural memory. It is a cultural memory that's still alive and well and shared by billions of people around the world.
Yeah, that's why I thought maybe in the year 400, even though, again, it had been hundreds of years later, maybe the Christians thought, you know, look, you know, the Jews had killed our Savior, Jesus, and, you know, we weren't even allowed to practice, and now we're free, and now we're the ones in control, so we're going to get them. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a little bit oversimplified, obviously, but it's not, you know, completely wrong in the sense that, again, these are two religious traditions that lay claim to the same biblical heritage, right? And so, for at least, in the minds of at least some, there can only be one true Israel, right? Who's, and which one? Yeah, right.
So what is the picture that you're seeing with the unearthing of this, you know, the mosaics and all this, how were Jews treated, let's say, in 400s and beyond?
You know, it's really interesting. So again, the picture that we have, it's kind of almost contradictory in a way, because as we said, on the one hand, the archaeological remains indicate an unexpectedly high level of prosperity, right? The houses that are built in this period, the amazing synagogue, which obviously was very costly and originally was very sort of prominent in the landscape. So you have that on the one hand, but then on the other hand, you have this selection of biblical stories in the mosaics that I'd say even more than hint, really kind of point to this expectation or this looking forward to an overthrow of the current world order and, you know, the establishment of God's kingdom on earth. And so it's kind of a, you know, it's almost like it's contradictory, right? On the one hand, they're prospering, apparently, you know, they're doing well, they're living well, they're building a beautiful synagogue building. But then on the other hand, looking forward to the overthrow of the current world order.
And also in the 400s, I thought that's when Rome was declining, maybe because they were falling apart. They just let it go. And the Jews weren't persecuted maybe when they otherwise would have been because they were too busy, you know, falling apart. I don't know. It's a coincidence. It's either.
Yeah, not exactly, actually. But again, it's not, you know, I mean, that would be kind of the general picture that you would have of the later Roman Empire. By this time, the Roman Empire had split into two halves by the time we're in the 5th century, right? The Roman Empire had split into two halves, and the area we're talking about was part of the Eastern Roman Empire, or what we call the Byzantine Empire. And that part of the empire actually continued to do pretty well until you get into the 6th century, especially after the death of Justinian in the mid-6th century. So even though the western half of the empire started to sort of fall apart in the 5th century, not true of the area that we're in. And so it's not really quite that. And again, if you read later Roman legislation, the kind of laws that are promulgated by the later Roman emperors, it would appear that the Jews were kind of you know, really marginalized and oppressed and increasingly so. But again, that's not the picture that we get from archaeology. Now, you know, there are several problems here, which is that the picture that we have from later Roman legislation isn't necessarily an accurate picture of what's going on around the Roman world, and especially not in sort of a rural area like Galilee, you know, not kind of centrally located near the capital or anything like that. So we don't know how well those laws were enforced. And in fact, they probably weren't enforced all that well, which is why they kept getting reissued.
What about rabbinical writings? Was like the Talmuds coming into, you know, the Midrashes and all this should have been around at the time. Does it say anything?
Well, and there exactly is both the good news and the bad news. So here's the thing. So without archaeology, if we want to learn about what's happening with Jews and Judaism in this period from a Jewish point of view, right, from Jewish sources, the only written records that we have, the only literature that we have from this period is rabbinic literature, which was literature that was produced by a relatively small elite group of men in Palestine and Babylonia, and much of it, by the way, produced in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries, and then the Babylonian Talmud goes a little later than that. And so the good news is that we have this literature that there's a lot of it, right? We have a huge corpus of rabbinic literature. The rabbis, even though they were a relatively small group, were very diverse in their views. They didn't agree with each other a lot of the time. And when they wrote their writings, they often recorded their disagreements. So they would often say, this rabbi says this, but this rabbi says this. Imagine that they disagreed with each other, right? So the good news is that we have this very large, diverse corpus of literature that records different views, but their views were diverse, but within a certain spectrum, right? So now the problem is that we don't have other Jewish writings from this period. Like we don't have a Josephus, for example, from this period. We don't have a Philo from this period. We don't have anything else from this period. We don't have Dead Sea Scrolls from this period. We have rabbinic literature. And so without the archaeological remains, if you study Judaism in this period, pretty much what you're getting is you're getting it from the perspective of what the rabbis wrote. And that means you're getting it from even though we have a lot of it and it's diverse and whatever, but it's still a relatively narrow perspective. And there is really, I would say there's nothing in rabbinic literature that would have led us to expect the existence of synagogues like the synagogue at Hukok with the mosaics that we have. Nothing that would have indicated we have buildings like this decorated with these kinds of figured images.
You mean like the level of complaints in the literature doesn't support the fact that things actually may have been better than they said?
No, it's not that at all, actually. In fact, the rabbis really don't talk about Christians and Christianity all that much. In fact, very little, as a matter of fact. And that's kind of an interesting thing as well, actually. But no, actually, the thing is that if you look at rabbinic literature, you wouldn't guess that there were synagogue buildings, not just Jewish art, but actual synagogue buildings decorated with figured images, people, animals, you know, whatever. Even, by the way, pagan Roman gods, like the Greco-Roman sun god Helios, you would never guess that there were synagogue buildings decorated in this way just from reading rabbinic literature. In other words, rabbinic literature gives us a certain perspective, but a relatively narrow picture and perspective on ancient Judaism, on Judaism in the period after 70, let's say. What archaeology does is it increases our perspective. It widens the lens, so to speak, by showing us that Judaism was in fact far more vibrant and in fact far more diverse than what we would have expected from rabbinic literature. I personally don't think we should be surprised at this, because Judaism has always been very vibrant and diverse, but it's archaeology that has preserved sort of this different or additional picture that we wouldn't get just from rabbinic literature alone.
Well, the rabbis probably weren't the artisans that made things like mosaics or built. I guess they were more like the intellectuals. So maybe that's why the biblical archaeology, you would see very little, let's say, from the rabbis, unless you found writings from there, you know, in scrolls or in other formats.
True, except that you would have expected that the rabbis would have visited these synagogues. In fact, you know, we know that there were rabbis in these settlements. There are rabbis mentioned as visiting Hukok, for example. And so you would have expected that they might have referred to the synagogues, or referred to the mosaics, if nothing else, either to say, oh, there are beautiful mosaics in the synagogue, or to say, oh, those are bad Jews there who are decorating their synagogues with pagan images, right?
Are there earlier writings where they historically did that, or maybe that's the nature of them, not to comment on such things. I don't know.
Well, there the problem is, and here we have a little bit of a chronological problem, too, with using rabbinic literature for the period of, like, the Hukkok synagogue, which is that, again, if we're talking about the Mishnah and the Jerusalem Talmud, for example, we're talking basically second, third, and first half of the fourth centuries, whereas the overwhelming majority of synagogues that are decorated with figured images date to the latter part of the fourth century, this century, and sixth century. So there's also that problem as well.
So what would you look for from an archaeological perspective that would sway you one way or another? Do you believe you found it with these mosaics, or what else could there be that you think that would really give you a decisive answer?
By the way, I'm not the one that needs to be swayed. It's many of my Israeli colleagues.
Oh, tell me about that. What do they say that?
No, yeah. Many of my Israeli colleagues have this view that Jews and Jewish settlements, you know, were oppressed and declined with the rise of Christianity when Christianity became the legal and official religion of the Roman Empire. And I think archaeology does not support that view. Part of the disagreement, and here I don't want to really get into the weeds, but part of the disagreement has to do with the dating of these synagogue buildings. Because if you argue that the synagogues are earlier in date than they would predate, or these settlements that go along with them, then they would predate, antedate the rise of Christianity. And then you could actually say, well, yes, then in that case, these are earlier. And in fact, we do see a decline after the rise of Christianity. And that was part of the reason I undertook my excavation, was in order to try and accurately date a synagogue building like this and the accompanying village to see exactly where this goes in the spectrum.
I'll say all right, so the dating is critical, it sounds like.
The dating is critical.
What did you do in terms of the dating to make sure it was as strong as it could be?
Yes. So in the periods that I work in Israel, the usual methods of dating rely on pottery and coins. And so coins, of course, carry a date, and pottery can be dated based on its style. It's a very complex to explain. But anyway, so usually if we find certain types of pottery, or if we find coins which have a date on them, then you have some indication approximately of the date of whatever it is you're excavating. So we did use pottery and coins, and we have some pretty good evidence of that. But we also did something that hasn't been done until now in other synagogues in this area. And that is, we also have radiocarbon dating of charcoal samples and scenes from the bedding of the mosaics and the fills under the mosaics. And all of the evidence that we have, the pottery, the coins, the radiocarbon dating, are all giving us pretty much the same date, that the synagogue was constructed around 400. And we have, again, the construction of houses in the village nearby, which were constructed at around that same time.
Okay, so, you know, what are the error bars in the dating you've done? Like, how close are you thinking?
Oh, I think we're actually pretty close. The pottery dating is very interesting because we have, among other things, in the foundation trench of the east wall. Here we're getting into the weeds again, I apologize. But in the foundation trench of the east wall of the synagogue, so when they're actually building the synagogue, they have to dig a big trench in the ground for the foundations, which is the part that goes underground, and then that gets filled in as the superstructure is built. So anything that you find in the foundation trench, right, in the foundations, that will be from the period when that will have been deposited when the building was being built. And therefore, the latest datable artifact that you find in the foundations will give you what we call a terminus postquem for construction, meaning a date after which, right? The building couldn't have been constructed any earlier than the date of the latest datable artifact. So I give my students this example. We're sitting in my office and I say, let's imagine now that we tear up the floor of my office and we find a bunch of stuff underneath from all different periods, but the latest datable artifact happens to be a penny that was minted in 1972. Well, that means that the floor could not have been laid before 1972 when that coin was minted.
Yeah.
It could have been, because the floor then is laid on top, it's sealed, right? It could have been laid any time after 1972. It could have been laid in 1972 or any time after 1972. That's a terminus postquem, but not before then. So we have the same thing. We have a certain type of imported pottery that's pretty well dated, actually.
With coins in particular, could you also look at the amount of wear on the coin, and would that further hone in on the date? Might it be a nice anchor?
Sometimes that actually is a factor. In our case, the latest coins, there's a factor in using coins in this period, which has to do with patterns of how many coins were minted in a given year and were in circulation at any one time. there are periods when fewer coins are minted, but the earlier coins remain in circulation. Anyway, it's a little bit complicated. So the latest coins that we have go up to basically the mid 4th century, but then we have this imported type of pottery that's later that actually goes up to the late 4th century. So that gives us a late 4th century terminus postquem. And then we have the radiocarbon dating of these samples from inside the synagogue, from the bedding of the mosaics, so the plaster into which the mosaics were set, and from under that. And that also is giving us exactly that same late 4th/early 5th century, again around the year 400. So all of the good dating evidence that we have is pointing in exactly the same direction. It's very consistent.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
What about the pottery? You said you didn't want to get into the weeds too much, but what are things about pottery that will tell you when it was made?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you're asking because my PhD dissertation was on pottery. But I usually try not to bore people with it because it's like kind of a technical thing. But, you know, pottery is the most common find on archaeological excavations in Israel for pretty much any period from the point when it's invented, you know, when it starts to be used, which is going back to the Neolithic period, the New Stone Age. So it's extremely common. It's very durable, right? It survives, whereas organic materials typically do not, although it can break into pieces. But unlike coins, for example, or unlike radiocarbon dating, pottery doesn't carry its own date, right? There's no, when you pick up a piece of broken pottery, it doesn't tell you what year it was made. So the only way to date pottery, there's no lab-based method at this point for dating pottery. So the only way to date pottery is to create what's called a relative typology, meaning a relative sequence of types. So you look for, you trace the development of different kinds of pottery vessels, bowls, plates, cups, storage jars, cooking pots, oil lamps, whatever. You trace their development in archaeological layers, what we call strata, you know, over the course of time. And so you kind of lay out, oh, we can see that, you know, cooking pots changed in this way over the course of time. They don't all change in the same way and they don't all change at the same time, but you lay out a relative typology. And then what you do is you then look for, once you've created that, you look to see if you have any datable artifacts associated with those specific types, right? So if I have a certain type of cooking pot that I know it's in the early part of my sequence of cooking pots, right? So then I'm going to see, oh, this cooking pot was found in this level at this site with, let's say, a coin dated to the time of Augustus, right? And so then I'll say, oh, well, apparently this cooking pot was used in the time of Augustus. And when I dig the next site down the road and I find the same kind of cooking pot, you know, oh, yeah, we had that down the road in the time of Augustus. It's far more complicated than what I'm explaining here, but that's kind of how it works. And it's very difficult because, you know, many different pottery types were in use at any one time. Obviously, they didn't all change in style at the same time. So just because cooking pots changed in type doesn't mean that the bowls or the storage jars did. And if you go from one area to another, you get different pottery types. So, for example, my dissertation was on the pottery of Jerusalem in the late Roman and Byzantine periods. But if you go to Galilee in exactly the same period, the period that we have at Hukok, for example, the pottery types are completely different.
Oh, why is that?
Because most pottery, not all of it, but most pottery was manufactured and marketed locally because pottery is easily breakable. Most of it was pretty inexpensive. So most of it was manufactured locally, either at the household level or in workshops, and then marketed locally, acquired locally. You know, it wasn't transported long distances typically because it broke.
What would be similar and what would be different about pottery from Galilee versus Jerusalem like this?
It's completely different. Completely different. Everything looks different. The forms, the surface decoration, everything. It's all different. It's like a different world. So, and I'm talking about the local wares. These aren't the fine wares. So the difference is fine wares, which are like your fine china that you would set your table with or something like that, right? So that kind of expensive stuff, that gets transported, that's expensive. So it gets transported distances, and you'll find a lot of imports among that. So that type of pottery that I mentioned that we found in that foundation trench, that piece, that's actually imported from Cyprus. It's a Cypriot type. It's a fine ware. So it made its way to Hukok somewhere around the year 400, or probably actually before that, ended up getting broken and, you know, got deposited with dirt inside the foundation trench. So the types of pottery that typically get moved distances, right, that aren't local, are either your fine wares, your fine china, which are worth spending money on to set a nice table if you can afford it, or containers for goods that are worth transporting long distances, like imported wine or imported oil or, you know, stuff like that.
But what about, I don't know if any religious iconography was made with, you know, ceramics, but is there any religious-based vessels or other things that, you know, they were prescribed, it's supposed to be this height, this length, this width, have these markings on it, et cetera? Is there anything that would unify the creation of pottery across distances at that time?
No, not that I can think of offhand. No, I mean, you know, it's very, again, it's just very utilitarian, right? So the way to think about it is that let's think for a minute about cooking pots and dishes that you dine off of or set your table with. So what they're going to reflect are your culinary habits, your diet and your dining habits, right? So the kind of food you eat and how you prepare that food. And so changes in cookingware types over time, the kinds of cooking pots you use, or the dishes that you use to set your table will reflect changes in your dining habits and the way that you cook and prepare food over the course of time. And so, for example, just to give you an example, one of the things that we find in Galilee in the Roman period, beginning in the first century AD, and then going up all the way to, well, depends on who you ask, but it leads to the fifth century, let's say. So for hundreds of years, we get this kind of thing that's called locally a Galilean bowl, which is kind of a broad, shallow pan that has short vertical walls, more or less. They can actually, they're a little bit inverted. And it's cookingware. It was clear it was used for cooking. And these apparently were used for cooking quiches and yeah. And they're very popular in Galilee. And they reflect the adoption among the population in Galilee. And by this, I mean the Jewish population in Galilee, of a type of dish that was very popular among the Romans, which were quiches and frittatas, which were, you know, you beat up an egg or eggs and you pour them over something, whether it's meat or fish or vegetables or fruit or whatever, right?
But let's say there was a, what if there was a meal for, you know, you had Passover and it was very specific and they only used a certain pot for it and it had certain designs on it that would be universal. Did anything like that exist?
No, we don't have anything like that. And in fact, the pottery in this period, unless you look at Roman pottery, like there's a Roman kiln works in Jerusalem that was a military kiln works where the pottery used by the 10th Legion was produced. Unless you're looking at that, the pottery that's manufactured locally pretty much is plain. It's not, doesn't have figured images or anything like that on it. But so very, so, but what's so interesting then is that apparently already in the first century, the Jews of Galilee, you know, started to make a lot of quiches and frittatas. But what's interesting is that we don't find that same kind of a vessel in Judea, in the area around Jerusalem. And so you see these kind of regional differences. And again, the differences reflect a lot of the time the kinds of foods that were being consumed, the way they were being prepared, and the way they were being served.
Okay. No, interesting that some things had to be similar. Like, you know, obviously the mosaics, they couldn't show different stories than what were in the Bible. But yet pottery, it's just totally practical. It sounds like secular and practical.
It is. Mostly is practical. Again, most of it is just, you know, locally produced and not exported long distances. And that's because unless you're producing a really fine product, right? Or unless you are creating a container for something that's going to be shipped a long distance, then pretty much the pottery will just have a very limited distribution. It's interesting. I just mentioned these kind of Galilean bowls. They were manufactured at a workshop in Galilee at a place called Kfar Hanania. And they were actually marketed pretty widely in certain parts of Galilee, especially among Jewish sites. And so this is a kind of pottery that apparently was preferred by Jews in connection with the observance of the laws of purity laws, which are connected to the manufacture and distribution of pottery. And then there were also local, a sort of a local variant or variants of the same type that were produced in the Golan in the areas where you had a significant Jewish population in the Golan at the same time.
Very interesting. Do you know anything about the pottery that held the Dead Sea Scrolls? Or have you talked to any scholars that have analyzed it?
That's one of my fields. What about it?
Tell me. I mean, is it all very similar? Is it all over the place? Is it just like they grabbed whatever they could and stuff in it, or what?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So, but now we're going back in time. So now we're going to be talking about the site of Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, which is on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea. Basically, we're talking about a site that dates to the first century BC and first century AD up to the year 68 AD, when it's destroyed by the Romans at the time of the first Jewish revolt. So we're talking about a late Second Temple period site here, right? We're not in late antiquity anymore. We've moved back in time. Now, that site, the site of Qumran, has a potter's workshop. And apparently, they manufactured their own pottery for their own purposes. In general, the repertoire of pottery that we have at Qumran is pretty similar to what you would find elsewhere in Judea at the same time. A little bit of, some minor differences, but overall, the same shapes of cups and plates and bowls and storage jars and cooking pots and things like that. But there are also, at Qumran, types of pottery that are distinctive to Qumran, very, very conspicuously. And one of those very conspicuous distinctive types are these tall cylindrical pottery jars that were covered with bowl-shaped lids, which reportedly contained the first scrolls that were found in Cave 1 at Qumran, but also were found in large numbers in other caves around Qumran and also in the site of Qumran itself, but for all intents and purposes are not found at any other site. That's almost a true blanket statement. A little bit of qualification there. But anyway, so it's interesting that we do have at Qumran a small number of types and very conspicuously, again, the cylindrical jars that are pretty much unique to Qumran. And I long ago wrote an article considering why cylindrical jars. In other words, why there must be a reason why they manufactured these jars, why they were suitable for their purposes. I don't think that they were originally intended to store scrolls, or at least not only scrolls. I think they were multi-purpose storage jar containers. But, you know, I went through a whole bunch of reasonings trying to figure out why they liked that particular shape of jar, which is so very distinctive.
Yeah, what if they expected someone to find it? Could there have been a jar type or a pottery type where the person would be like, that's probably garbage, forget it. Yeah, that would be overlooked.
No, I don't think so. And in fact, the fact that they were deposited in caves, hidden in caves, well, at least the scrolls were hidden in caves, right? Doesn't suggest to me that they intended them to be found. What I think is that some of the scrolls were stored in the adjacent caves just for storage purposes already during the lifetime of the sect, but of the sect that lived at Qumran, right? But that on the eve of the destruction by the Romans in 68 AD, that more scrolls were deposited in the caves for safekeeping. And they intended to come back and retrieve them, but obviously that never happened.
Is there any difference in the pottery? Is there only one kind? No, is it a mishmash of anything practical? Or?
Well, I mean, there are differences. Again, you have a repertoire of types, but most of the types are pretty, you know, standard or, you know, typical. There are, again, a few weird little differences, but overall it's pretty much what you would expect in this period. But what's interesting is that the pottery itself, some of the pottery vessels, have been subjected to different kinds of scientific analyses. So there's a kind of analysis called petrographic analysis of clay. There's another kind called neutron activation analysis. And the point of those analyses is to determine what the source of the clay was, right? Where did the clay come from that the pottery was manufactured? So these different analyses have indicated that a lot of the pottery, can't say most of it because, but a lot of the pottery apparently was manufactured of a kind of clay called Motza Marl, which is characteristic sort of the area. If you go up into the mountains towards Jerusalem and then move southwards from there, there are outcrops of this sort of marl, this Motza Marl. These analyses have also indicated that there are other sources of clay that were used, although none in the immediate vicinity of Qumran so far. But what's really interesting is that the clay of the pottery from the caves with the scrolls and the clay of the pottery found in the site, it's the same clay. So the importance of that is that it indicates a scientific connection between the site of Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls, indicating that the people who lived at Qumran were in fact the ones who deposited the scrolls in the nearby caves.
Oh, okay. So it was done by the people that lived there. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Is there any way to tell over what time period they put stuff in the caves, or is it way too time?
Yeah, you know, I tried to do that once. I tried to separate that out. There was a very interesting theory at one point that was suggested by a scholar that you could sort of separate out old caves and new caves, that some of the caves had appeared to have been had scrolls put in them earlier versus other caves which appeared to have scrolls put in them later. Right, during the lifetime of the settlement. And I thought, that's an interesting idea. Let's see if, and this was based on his study of the scrolls. But I thought, that's an interesting idea. Let's look at the pottery types and see whether, because we can actually tell first century pottery over BC pottery overall from first century AD, right? There are differences. So let's see if that kind of supports that. And I you know, tried to organize the pottery. And I found that in some cases it supported it, but in some cases it didn't. So it wasn't, again, it wasn't like this clear, unequivocal picture
It makes sense. Okay. What current archaeological questions are you working on and looking to answer? And then, we can kind of wrap from there. I know I took you down the pottery
you did.
Lane, but it's interesting, no, actually. Great. So, yeah.
I thank you because, you know, hardly anybody ever asked me about pottery. And like I said, you know, I that's what I started out specializing in, and I'm still working on pottery until now. So, but I rarely get to talk about it. Well, you know, I'll do a little promo, right? I just had a big book published a couple of weeks ago, last month, Jerusalem Through the Ages, From Its Beginnings to the Crusades. It's a really big book. It's aimed at the kind of listeners that you would have for your program. So, you know, people who are fairly knowledgeable, but not necessarily specialists who want to know more. And it's, you know, a really thorough survey of the history and archaeology of Jerusalem right up through the Crusades. So that's out with Oxford University Press, and it's available through Amazon. So that's the big thing that's out now. As far as my next big project is the publication of my dig. So I didn't mention this before. I started my dig at Houkouk in 2011. Last summer, 2023, was my last season of excavation there. Not that we finished the whole site. We did not. We finished the synagogue. We finished excavating the synagogue and all the mosaics. There's a big courtyard to the east of the synagogue. We didn't finish that. But I've stopped now because now what we have to do is turn to publication. And I kind of mentioned this early on. You know, the goal of archaeology is not excavation, it's publication. Because in the course of excavating, we destroy the evidence. And the only way to make that accessible to others is through publication. So I'm now the proud owner of two shipping containers filled with excavated material from our excavations, which are on the grounds of the Albright Institute in Jerusalem. And so beginning this summer, my senior staff and I will be having a study season in Jerusalem to sit and start working on the preparation of the final excavation report, which will ultimately be published in several volumes and will take years to complete. So that's the next big project. And then, you know, I have a number of other, you know, smaller projects that I'm working on, things like conference papers and, you know, articles and you know, things like that.
Well, very good. Very good. Where can people find out more about your work? Where can they go?
Yeah, thank you. Well, as you mentioned at the beginning, I have a website. It's my name. I'm an org. So it's just my name, one word, jodimagnus.org. And if they're interested in Houkouk, in the excavations at Houkouk, we have a dig website, which is just houkouk.org. Houkouk, by the way, is spelled, it looks a little weird in English. It's spelled H-U-Q-O-Q. There's a link to it on my website. And if people are interested in learning more about Houkouk, on the dig website, we have tabs with the media coverage, with our publications. So more information there as well.
Well, very good. Well, Jody, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at findinggeniuspodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.